From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Behold, Arthur, this is the Holy Grail. Look well, Arthur, for it is your sacred task to seek this grail. That is your purpose, Arthur. The quest for the Holy Grail.
A blessing from the Lord. God be praised.
The 1975 movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail has been theatrically re-released and will be out on DVD this fall. On today's archive edition, we hear interviews with four members of the British comedy group. Also, we remember Chico O'Farrell, one of the originators of Afro-Cuban jazz. He died Wednesday at the age of 79. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews AI. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The Senate is moving towards passage of a so-called Patients' Bill of Rights. It would allow all Americans with private or public health insurance access to emergency care and medical specialists. It would let most patients sue in federal court over benefits, and it would allow patients to sue insurers in state courts over denials of coverage if they're based on medical judgment. NPR's Steve Inskeep is at the Capitol. And Steve, what's happening right now on the Senate floor?
Paul, they've just finished the final debates on this. They're doing votes on a last couple of amendments, and then they will vote on the overall bill itself. But even this bill's opponents now concede it will pass. This bill is going to pass tonight.
Steve, if the Patients' Bill of Rights passes in this form, how certain is it that President Bush would veto it?
Well, the president did warn that he would veto this bill unless it changed. He says it's too easy to sue businesses. Now, they did make some changes in the Senate over the last few days. They exempted most businesses from lawsuits. Republicans still say it's not enough, but it would be awfully hard for the president to veto this popular legislation.
That's NPR's Steve Inskeep at the Capitol. A high-ranking immigration official in Florida who was convicted of spying for Cuba has been sentenced to 5 years in prison. From Miami, NPR's Philip Davis has more.
Mariano Fajet was once the number two man in the Miami office of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, but FBI officials were suspicious of his friendship with a man who had alleged contacts with Cuban intelligence. The FBI then ran a sting operation targeting the 55-year-old bureaucrat. Agents gave him bogus classified information and watched as Fajet promptly shared the information with the alleged Cuban intelligence contact. A jury convicted Fajet of disclosing classified information and lying about his contacts with a Cuban official. Fajet could have faced up to 12 years in prison, but U.S. District Judge Alan Gold gave him the minimum sentence of 5 years. Gold said prosecutors did not prove that Fajet had actually endangered U.S. security. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Vice President Dick Cheney will undergo heart tests at George Washington University Hospital tomorrow. Doctors will try to determine whether they need to implant a device that regulates heartbeat and, when necessary, restarts the heart. Cheney has experienced some brief episodes of irregular heartbeat recently. He told reporters he plans to be back at work on Monday. Software giant Microsoft said today it will not accept any antitrust lawsuit settlement with the government that changes the company's structure. Yesterday, a federal appeals court overturned a lower court order that Microsoft be split in two. One attorney general, one of the 19 of states that brought the suit, said states don't want any preconditions on settlement terms. The Dow Industrials closed down 64 points today at 10,502 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 36 at 2161. This is NPR News. The American Medical Association has fired its chief executive officer after he filed a lawsuit against the AMA. NPR's Marianne Akers reports.
The AMA released a terse statement saying that the Board of Trustees has terminated the contract of Dr. E. Ratcliffe Anderson. Anderson had served as the executive vice president of the AMA since 1998. He was hired then to reform the organization after an ethics embarrassment. The group had decided to endorse health-related products made by Sunbeam. That deal never went through, and AMA board members say they never knew about the Sunbeam decision until it was made public. But Anderson claims the board did know. The allegation came to light in a lawsuit he filed 2 weeks ago. The AMA has dismissed the lawsuit as frivolous, but members have expressed serious concern that another controversy will further weaken the organization. Membership in the AMA has plummeted in recent years. The group now represents just a third of U.S. physicians. Marianne Akers, NPR News, Chicago.
Elliot Abrams, the Iran-Contra figure who pleaded guilty to withholding information from Congress and was later pardoned by President George Bush, has been given a new job in the present Bush administration. He'll be senior director of the National Security Council's Office for Democracy, Human Rights, and International Operations. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said the president has full confidence in Abrams and thinks his role in the Iran-Contra scandal is a matter of the past that was dealt with at the time. The chief war crimes prosecutor at the UN tribunal in The Hague today called the extradition of former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic a turning point in the hunt for those responsible for atrocities in the Balkans. But the extradition prompted angry demonstrations by about 6,000 Milosevic supporters in Yugoslavia. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating its 75th anniversary of investing in communities and strengthening people, on the web at mott.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1975 movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the Python's parody of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, has been theatrically re-released. It's already opened in several cities and will open in more over the next few weeks. On today's Archive Edition, we're going to hear from several of the founding members of the British comedy group. Here's a scene from The Holy Grail. In the search for the Holy Grail, they uncover a clue carved in a cave wall.
There! Look! What does it say? What language is that? Brother Maynard,
you're our scholar.
It's Aramaic. Of course, Joseph of Arimathea.
Of course.
What does it say? It reads, here may be found the last words of Joseph of Arimathea. He who is valiant and pure of spirit may find the Holy Grail in the castle of...
What?
The castle of...
What is that?
He must have died while carving it.
Oh, come on.
Well, that's what it says.
Look, if he was dying, he wouldn't bother to carve Argh. He'd just say it.
Well, that's what's carved in the rock.
Perhaps he was dictating.
Oh, shut up.
Well, does it say anything else?
No. Just...
That was Eric Idle translating the Aramaic. Idle wrote many of the comic songs used in Python sketches and movies. When I spoke with him in 1999, he performed some of the songs he wrote during his years with the Pythons. He had just published his comic science fiction novel, The Road to Mars, set in the 24th century. The main character is an android named Carlton, who's writing a thesis on the nature of 20th century comedy, investigating whether there's a comedy gene. As part of his research, he's watching tapes of old TV shows. Here's a reading.
He thinks he almost finds some evidence with one of the guys on a very weird show called Monty Python's Flying Circus. I've seen the tapes, and boy, does it suck. It's strange rather than funny. Five limeys and a yank. No girls, they did drag. Typical Brits. They're never happier than when dressing up as women. What is it with them? It's a stupid show, as I say, and Carlton found it totally puzzling. Heads come off or pop open in demented animations. Sheep drop on people's heads for no reason whatsoever. Vikings sing love songs to pressed meat. Weird men dressed as old ladies squeak in silly voices. There are dead parrots and Spanish Inquisitions. It's all very silly nonsense. They seem dangerously cuckoo to me. Carlton couldn't make head or tail of it. But it seemed from the tape that the audience laughed. As far as he could tell, it was genuine, not canned laughter. In casually cross-checking the genetic backgrounds of the six strange men involved, he turned up an ancestor for one of them in showbiz. Eric Idle's great-grandfather, Henry Bertrand, a Victorian gentleman from the 1890s, had been a circus manager. Was this the genetic missing link? His great-grandfather was a ringmaster in a circus, and Idle was in a flying circus? Surely this was significant. Of course it wasn't. Turned out Idle was screwed up by losing his RAF rear gunner father in a traffic accident in World War II. Irony, eh? Killed coming home from on Christmas leave after surviving the war. This was compounded by being stuck in a semi-orphanage for 12 years with a bunch of fatherless boys. The circus thing was just a coincidence. But you can see the lengths he went to in searching for the comedy gene.
Well, thanks for reading that excerpt of your book, The Road to Mars. And before I get to some of the things about your biography that are referred to in that passage, I want to ask you a little bit about the comedy of Monty Python. I mean, it looks ridiculous to Carlton centuries after the fact. He doesn't understand at all the surrealism and visual and verbal non sequiturs that the Python's comedy was based on. And I'm wondering why you think that so much of the Python comedy was based on surrealism and non sequiturs.
Well, first of all, Carlton doesn't get it because he's an android. He doesn't get much.
Good point. Thank
you. He has no sense of irony whatsoever. And if you tell him to say, people say, like, get out of here, he leaves the room. And that's part of his problem, really. He can't understand the secondary levels of meaning in language, which is where comedy lurks. And also, it's kind of fun to sort of abuse Python from the future. It's kind of a nice, comfortable position to look back at our own work.
But getting back to the question of why so much of the Python humor was about surrealism and visual and verbal non sequiturs.
I think that we thought it was reality. I think that that's the way we look at things. I mean, it isn't really non sequiturs. The world doesn't make much sense, and we always try and pretend it does. And comedy's job is to point out that it doesn't make any sense and it doesn't matter that much. And perhaps we reflected that a bit.
I thought we could take a break here and listen to another one of your songs. And this is a song that was done in the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian. And the song is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Set up for us how this song is used at the very end of The Life of Brian. And Brian is somebody whose life parallels the life of Jesus, and he ends up crucified on the cross at the end of the movie. Tell us about the song here.
Well, we had to face a complex problem of how to deal with all our characters. We're heading towards crucifixion, and there was no way of getting out of it. It was a common form of death for the Romans. It was like public hanging, you know. So we knew they were all going to have to die, and we couldn't face how could we deal with this image of the crucifixion. And we knew we were going to have a lot of people crucified because the Romans were fond of mass crucifixions. And so I said, well, let's do a song, you know, and it should be a cheery song. And so we thought the idea of people sort of singing a rather bright song as they being crucified, because they've got a couple of days, was a kind of wonderfully British sort of way of looking at things. And so I went off and I just came back and wrote this little quick little ditty, which has become an anthem in England for the many times we lose at sport.
And, of course, in the movie, your character's getting crucified as well, and you kind of kick off the song, and then all the guys getting crucified join in.
Yes. It's a rousing experience.
Would you sing it for us?
Sure. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. 'Cause life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. And always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. For life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
always look on that bright side of life.
That's a great song, and I love the way you do it. I love the whistling, that little, and that little trombone sound that you get at the end there. That's new, isn't it?
Well, I've always been able to do that. It's kind of a boarding school thing. When you're stuck at boarding school for 12 years, one of the things you learn to do are silly and pointless things that help to pass the time. So I can do, you know, I can do horn, French horn, and various things. I've used them on records, too. It's cheaper than musicians.
I think, you know, your most famous Python sketch is the Nudge Nudge Wink Wink sketch, two men meeting for the first time in a bar. Did you write this sketch?
Yes, I did write the sketch.
Tell us about how you wrote it.
I wrote it for another show. I wrote it for Ronnie Barker, who was one of the two Ronnies. And I sent it in to some Frost show. And they sent it back unused because, of course, if you look at the script, it's incredibly boring. There are no jokes in it. It says, is your wife a goer? Know what I mean, know what I mean. Say no more, say no more. Nudge, nudge, know what I mean. Say no more, nudge, 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 nudge. It just comes straight back. And then I thought, well, that was rather funny. So I read it out at one of the really early Python meetings. Say, is your wife a goer? Eh? Know what I mean? Say no more, know what I mean. Nudge, nudge, eh? Wink, wink, eh? Is she a goer? Eh? Does she go? Eh? And, of course, they fell about because it's kind of in the performance. And it's sometimes it's very hard to read comedy scripts. That's why Hollywood is so notoriously bad at reading comedy scripts, because it's often in just as the way you do it. I mean, I once picked up a Cleese sketch, a headmaster sketch, and I thought, there's nothing funny about this. And then I saw him do it, and he just reduced me to tears.
What kind of guy inspired this sketch?
The Nudge Boy is very much an English wide boy. He's, you know, he's down a pub. He's always down a pub, and he's, you know, he's a bit of a Jack the Lad. He rather fancies himself. But, of course, it's rather sad at the end. You know, he says, you know, you've slept with a lady. Yes. What's it like? So he's sort of kind of, he's that irritatingly nudgy person that really people don't behave like if they are well-behaved.
Well, let me play the Python sketch.
Your wife interested in photography, eh? Photographs, eh? He asked him knowingly.
Photography, eh?
Yeah. Snap, snap, grin, grin, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Oh, holiday stamps.
Could be. Could be taken on holiday, could be. Swimming costumes. Nudge, nudge. Candid photography.
No, I'm afraid we don't have a camera.
Oh. Still. Oh, eh? Eh? Oh!
Look, are you trying to insinuate something?
No, 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 no. Yes.
Well?
Well, I mean, you're a man of the world, aren't you? I mean, you know, you've been around, you've been there.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, you've done it, with a lady. You've slept with a lady.
Yes.
What's it like?
So after the sketch, Eric Idle, did people come up to you for years and do the whole nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing?
That's still probably the most quoted to me, yes. And people love it so much, I just enjoy doing it. So in my stage show, I'm doing him a bit more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now your father died in World War II.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances of his death? He was killed on the way home?
Well, it's just kind of ironic. You know, he was in the RAF from 1941, and he was a rear gunner in a bomber, in bombers and things, and that's a very dangerous role. And then they were coming home on leave, and they said, well, don't use the railways, they'll be crowded, it's coming towards Christmas time, you guys should hitchhike, because everybody gave the forces rides when they're in uniform. So he got a ride, and he was in the back of a lorry, a truck, and a car swerved and cut in front of them, and they went off the road, and he was crushed, and he sort of died on Christmas Eve. So it was kind of bitterly ironic, you know.
And I don't know how to say this exactly, but it kind of feeds the sense of tragic absurdity.
It certainly gives you a sense of irony. Of course, I was two and a bit, so I didn't really know why Christmases were so miserable and depressing. It really affected my mother. She never actually recovered from it. And she went into bleak depression. And part of my theory in the book is, and it's not just my theory, people I went into research a bit, is that comedians are formed by maternal abandonment. and that they seek to replace some kind of parental love that they're not getting by being cute and funny and doing anything to entertain and solicit this love and this laughter from strangers.
And so that's your theory about why you became a comedian?
It's probably accounts for why I did. I noticed on the playground with my daughter, who's 9, that when I go in there, I can tell which kids don't have mothers at home because they're being funny.
Eric Idle, recorded in 1999, he's one of the stars of the 1975 movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. The film has been theatrically re-released. Coming up, former Python Michael Palin. This is Fresh Air.
Alan Hutchison reads another extract from a series of bedside books.
Number 32. The lady lies with her left leg planted firmly on the ground and the right hand waiting. The gentleman with the melon switches on the battery and places his left thigh on the edge of the swivel table, keeping the neck of the stuffed goose absolutely...
Up next, we have an interview with Michael Palin, a founding member of the Pythons. He also co-starred in the Python films and in the film A Fish Called Wanda, in which he played the stuttering thief. In 1990, I asked him about his upbringing.
Well, I was a nice middle-class boy, I suppose. My mother didn't work. My father was an engineer by trade and was born and brought up in the south of England. He was a doctor's son. He became an export manager of a big steelworks in Sheffield. I don't think he really particularly wanted to do that. I mean, I think he'd actually been much happier to be a church organist, but one was sort of pushed into the professions then. And so we lived on really very low salary in quite a nice house in Sheffield.
You grew up after the war. How did the post-war days affect your sensibility, do you think? And, you know, your worldview when you were young?
Well, the days of austerity and scarcity here, and I can remember countries like America and Australia especially were like the land of plenty where all the opportunities were. It meant in a strange way that you sort of guarded what you had rather carefully. I mean, my father was a real notebook man and kept brown paper bags for several years, you know, and used to iron bits of string. It was that sort of thing, and had lots and lots of little tins with sort of, you know, left-handed cufflinks and things in one tin and bits of, you know, sort of old Brazil nut shells in another. We kept absolutely everything. And I quite like that. I'm still rather... I love detail myself, both in sort of life and work. I tend to notice bits of detail. And in a sense, it's made me sort of... Well, perhaps helped to make me feel very sort of fond of life and rather sort of... glad that I've got what I have now and that we are brought up in a time of comparative plenty.
The Pythons always had a lot of drag humor. I was wondering if you were ever taken to drag shows or, you know, to female impersonation shows when you were younger.
No, not really. I went to pantomime, which is a peculiarly English phenomenon, I think, isn't it? You don't have pantomime in America.
Well, explain what it is.
Well, it's a Christmas show based on a reworking of a fairy story like Jack and the Beanstalk or Babes in the Wood, in which the women play the men and the men play the women.
I don't think we have that.
Well, they have a principal boy, which is always played by a woman in a big pair of black tights and sort of little costume. She slaps her thigh a lot and, you know, the woman would play Dick Whittington, for instance, and say, "Come on, puss," and all that in a sort of very butch voice. And the men would play the ugly sisters in Cinderella. So that was my first... I suppose that, you know, every Christmas I would see men in getting laughs out of being in drag, playing things like the ugly sisters or Dick Whittington's mother or things like that. And they were always fairly incompetent. I don't know if that's a sign of, you know, how men saw themselves or how men saw women, but there you are.
How often did you dress in drag for the Python shows?
it sounds like sort of... drag addicts confessions, doesn't it? I'm not really that often. I should think probably once every other show, we got into women's outfits. Strange, isn't it, really? I must say we did quite enjoy it. Because Python was sort of rather like, I mean, people say, why didn't you get women to play the women in Python? But that wasn't really the point. Python itself was sort of a self-contained show where the six writers did everything. And the sort of many of the characters were rather sort of caricatures, or fairly outrageous, of a sort of cartoon feel to them. And so we were playing types of men rather than the man himself. And we were playing types of women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I never convinced myself as a woman, whereas someone like Eric or Graham could look really rather wonderful. And Terry Jones, used to play his mother regularly and was wonderful. You know, one could almost think, I wish Terry would stay like that. He'd make someone a wonderful mum.
Michael Palin recorded in 1990. We'll hear more from former Pythons in the second half of the show. The 1975 film, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, has been theatrically re-released and will be released on DVD this fall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Stop! Who would cross the bridge of death must answer me these questions, thee. The other side, he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
What is your name?
My name is Sir Lancelot of Camelot.
What is your quest?
To seek the Holy Grail.
What is your favorite color?
Blue.
Right, off you go.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. That's easy!
Stop! Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side, he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
What is your name?
Sir Robin of Camelot.
What is your quest?
To seek the Holy Grail.
What is the capital of Assyria?
I don't know that.
Is your name?
Sir Galahad of Camelot.
What is your quest?
I seek the Grail.
What is your favorite color?
Blue. No.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, a work of fiction by David Schickler. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Chico O'Farrell, one of the originators of Afro-Cuban jazz. He died Wednesday. Henry Sheehan reviews AI, Steven Spielberg's new movie. And we continue our interviews with members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1975 film Monty Python and the Holy Grail has been theatrically re-released and will come out on DVD this fall. On today's archive edition, we're listening to interviews with former Pythons. In 1987, I spoke with Graham Chapman. He died 2 years later, in 1989. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Graham Chapman was a trained physician and a gay rights activist. Before the interview, let's hear him in a classic Python sketch.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings.
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit. Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert.
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Ah, yes. You want room 12A just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Graham Chapman dishing out the abuse. I asked Chapman if his early sketches with Monty Python were considered too risque or eccentric.
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. They generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. Naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable, I suppose, because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
I think that there's a lot of British humour and Monty Python-type humour that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different?
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect, in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that will be pretty meaningless now.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
John and I wrote together, Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote together, Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe... anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then, about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything, and at that point we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation open up Roger's Thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's Thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wensleydale.
Yes?
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wensleydale, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola?
No.
Parmesan?
No.
Mozzarella? Pepper crema? No. Danish pepper.
When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or dump them.
Right,
yeah.
Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you don't. Fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his, and they seemed to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Graham Chapman recorded in 1987, 2 years before his death. Coming up, former Python John Cleese. This is Fresh Air. John Cleese is perhaps the most famous Monty Python player. He also starred in the film A Fish Called Wanda and in the BBC series Fawlty Towers. I spoke with him in 1990.
Now, so much of your humor has to do with, kind of skewering a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his...
Oh, yes, I'm
associates.
Sure that's right. And I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie Farnie sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work meetings often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off, and they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and the Tempertonies. Yeah, well, they might depose and overcall at the Murgle chooses. There's to be Lugus across the bottom, part of Isaac cruise together in mid slever the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slope of action. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're...
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is... when I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yes, you take the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958. And I've never forgotten it. They got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I used my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life mm-hmm. or into a parody of that.
Through writing and acting.
Yeah,
when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. And if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
He's grinning.
Your mother was an acrobat? Is it? This happens to me all the time.
I get fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No, so, you know, I always, like, very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually, like, one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten them. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
John Cleese recorded in 1990. The 1975 movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail has been theatrically re-released, and it's opening in selected cities. The DVD will follow in the fall. Stanley Kubrick spent years working on the film AI, but died before he could make it. Now Steven Spielberg has finished the task for him. The result is a science fiction saga set in the near future when global warming has caused the oceans to flood and science has taken huge steps forward in robot technology. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
It's way too early to decide where AI will finally fit in the frequently fascinating, sometimes exasperating, and always intriguing career of Steven Spielberg. The movie, whose initials stand for Artificial Intelligence, is in many ways a mess. It's structured in the conventional three-act Hollywood style, and its first two acts are typically tight. But the third act features two apparent climaxes, then an extended denouement, and then finally just wafts away into a conclusion that fails to resolve any key tensions. But the very fact that a filmmaker so orderly as Spielberg has made such an ungainly movie is arresting in itself. Even without that last third, AI would still be a compulsively watchable movie. Haley Joel Osment delivers a compelling performance as David, a little robot who's been designed not just to love, but to be loved in return. He's created by a Professor Hobby, played by William Hurt, who isn't just an inventor, but a businessman out to satisfy a growing market for second children. In a world devastated by floods, wealthy nations like the U.S. have maintained their resources by rationing their population, subjecting couples to a one-marriage, one-child formula. David is placed with the Swintons, Henry, an employee of Hobby, and Monica. Their own 10-year-old has been cryogenically frozen until a cure can be found for his terminal disease. David is meant as a replacement. The entire first third of the movie is taken up with David's intense, altogether real bonding with Monica and his subsequent expulsion from the Swinton household. Although David doesn't fully understand, Monica leaves him in the middle of a forest and tearfully warns him to avoid humans because he's slated for scientific demolition. This fairy tale-like turn leads to the more action-packed second section. David, who has been entranced by Monica's bedtime reading of Pinocchio, decides to look for the blue fairy, the magical being who turned the wooden puppet into a boy and might do the same for him. Along the way, he picks up a friend or two from a world of runaway robots, and his closest pal is Gigolo Joe, a professional sex partner for human women who's been framed for murder. Joe, well played by Jude Law, is frustrated by David's refusal to accept his status as a task-oriented collection of wires. Here, he addresses the boy in the bluntest terms.
She loves what you do for her. As my customers love what it is I do for them. But she does not love you, David. She cannot love you. You are neither flesh nor blood. You are not a dog or a cat or a canary. You were designed and built specific like the rest of us. And you are alone now only because they tired of you or replaced you with a younger model or were displeased with something you said or broke. They made us too smart, too quick, and too many.
Joe is also telling us what the movie is all about. He's telling David that he can't be loved because of his own unhuman nature. But there's also a third implicit point Gigolo Joe makes. He himself is a robot designed to pleasure women without getting them pregnant. Love that is facile and manufactured, love that cannot be returned, love that cannot be born. These are the three great tensions that run through AI, the ones that Spielberg ultimately can't resolve. As if rummaging through old cures, the filmmaker employs favorite images from the past and finds them wanting. The moon, that crucial symbol of freedom in E.T., in AI turns out to be a symbol of enslavement, used by a bizarre entrepreneur played by Brendan Gleeson. He rounds up runaway robots for demolition in fiery autos de fe that bring to mind Spielberg's own effects-laden movies. But all the film's fire is eventually subsumed by water in the troublesome, troubling, and magnificently clumsy third act. The sea, the mother of us all, now bringing death, or at least indifference, as it swells, swallow the world. Spielberg, after a lifetime of making movies about Peter Pan-like fathers, has made a movie about mother love.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Coming up, we remember Chico O'Farrell, one of the originators of Afro-Cuban jazz. He died this week. This is Fresh Air. Chico O'Farrell, one of the originators of Afro-Cuban jazz, died Wednesday at the age of 79. We're going to hear an interview recorded in February. O'Farrell grew up in Havana and moved to New York in 1948, where he wrote and arranged for Machito, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Kenton, and Benny Goodman. O'Farrell returned to Cuba in 1955, moved to Mexico in 57, and stayed there 8 years before moving back to New York. Jazz work dried up for him in the 70s and 80s, and he had to make his living writing and arranging commercial jingles. In 1995, he made a jazz comeback and began leading his Afro-Cuban jazz big band. Over the past few years, his band often performed in New York under the supervision of his son, pianist Arturo O'Farrell. Chico O'Farrell's best-known composition, the Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite, was first recorded in 1950. Charlie Parker was one of the soloists. On O'Farrell's latest CD, Carambola, he re-recorded the suite. That's the opening of the Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite from Chico O'Farrell's new CD, Carambola. You wrote the Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite after you moved to New York. And I'm wondering if you heard Cuban music in a different way once you started living in New York and once you started composing and arranging Afro-Cuban-inspired jazz.
Well, when I came to New York, my whole musical mind changed in a way that I was like a new musician. For one thing, I was listening to some of my idols in person, people like Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker. I was listening to these people in person, which is not the same as listening to records. And so my mind was very much more attuned to this type of thing than when I was living in Cuba.
When you were living in New York in the late 40s and early 50s, you did a lot of arranging for other people's bands.
Yes.
You did some arranging for Machito, for Dizzy Gillespie, for Benny Goodman, Stan Kenton.
Yes.
And you've described yourself as the ghostwriter of the ghostwriters.
Yeah, I was the ghost of the ghost.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm not going to name names, but certain big name arrangers were writing for Benny Goodman, Gun Bass, Dizzy Gillespie. And he didn't write a lot of it. He had a ghostwriter write it. And the ghostwriter eventually, had too much work.
So you were doing ghostwriting for people who were hired to arrange things and weren't getting much credit in the first place.
That's right.
But you must have learned a lot doing that.
Of course I did. That was the main reason I did it, so I was exposed directly to the musical medium that I loved and learned more about it.
What was your ethnic background in Cuba? Where were your parents from?
My father was originally from Ireland. Figure that out. And my mother was originally also from a German background. So I'm a mess, I admit it.
So what kind of music did they listen to when you were growing up?
I really don't remember much except them listening to Cuban, typical Cuban music. But they didn't do much music. They were no music lovers, really. I have to say that.
And what did they think of you listening to and then playing jazz?
They weren't very happy about it. As a matter of fact, I remember when I decided to become a musician, I was supposed to go to law school and become an attorney.
Your father and grandfather were both lawyers.
Right. So I was supposed to become an attorney and follow in the family's footsteps. But one day they said I was going to become a musician and I announced it to the family. And I remember my grandma was very, very austere, saying, "Arturo, if you're going to be a musician, be a good one. Remember Mozart."
So she wanted you to play classical music.
Yeah, she wanted me to do classical music. And for them, jazz, you know, including most popular music, jazz, and all of it was like a little bit vulgar music.
I want to play another track from your new CD. And this is called Crazy City, But I Love It. What's the city that this composition is about?
Well, guess. Chicago? Nah. Toronto? Nah.
Havana or New York?
How about New York? Try New York.
New York, okay.
Yeah, of course.
And what were the impressions of New York you wanted to capture in this piece?
I wanted to capture the musical sounds as well as the feeling of the city and the mixture of Latin and jazz rhythms, which is so typically unique of New York.
Well, this piece is called Crazy City, ... but I love it. Did you always love New York when you moved there, or did it take you a while to adjust to it?
No, I love it. The first minute I walked in here, I loved it.
How come?
There was something about the atmosphere. It was such a dynamic city, such a vibrant city. And especially because I was in love with jazz at the time, and this was the center of jazz. It became the center of my activities, so I loved it.
Thank you so much. I love your music, and I wish you the best.
Thank you, and I thank the public for listening to me, and you all have a good time.
Chico O'Farrell recorded last February. He died Wednesday at the age of 79. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Vintage Books, a division of Random House and publishers of the new paperback novel White Teeth by Zadie Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Walter Kern talks about his new novel, Up in the Air, a satirical look at the frustrations and discomforts of life in airports and airplanes. The main character is a business traveler whose goal is to earn 1 million frequent flyer miles. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.